Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is Division 7, back after a brief recess. The first case up for the second docket is marriage of Gwilym. Hope I pronounced that correctly. And I see that counsel are present and set up. Thank you very much. Ms. Gill.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Ann Gill. I'm here on behalf of Dorian Gwilym, the mom in this custody issue. The issue in this case really is whether a district court will function merely as a rubber stamp when the parties in the dissolution submit an agreement to it, or whether the district court has an independent duty to review the terms of the party's agreement. Here there was a stipulation which had a significant terms concerning the custody of the children and parenting time and how parenting time would be exercised. The thrust of the stipulation clearly contemplated an imminent relocation of dad with the kids out of state. That stipulation was submitted to the court in January of 07. The court took no action on that stipulation until July 28, 08, 19 months later. At the time that the district court did look at the stipulation and enter the order adopting it, it not only had not reviewed the terms of the stipulation as to whether it was an appropriate agreement between the parties, there were also two motions pending before the court which directly addressed the issues of which the stipulation purported to resolve. 15 months after the parties had entered into the stipulation, Mom retained counsel and because she wanted to expand her parenting time. She filed a motion to modify the stipulation and expand parenting time. In that motion, she alerted the court to the problems with the stipulation, that there had been no consideration of the best interest of the children when that stipulation was entered into, and that the time that she entered into that stipulation, which was in resolution of a contempt citation, her court-appointed counsel had failed to advise her of the consequences of this stipulation. After she filed that motion, the district court directed the parties to engage in mediation, which they did engage in the middle of July, July 14th. 4 days later, father's counsel mailed a letter to mom's counsel announcing his intent to relocate to St. George, Utah, which he was entitled to do under the terms of the stipulation without any consultation with mom. And he proceeded to implement that relocation. The stipulation had required that there would be therapy for the kids to adjust to the proposed relocation. There was not time to implement that before the relocation occurred. However, when Mom's counsel did receive that notice in the U.S. mail, she immediately filed a forthwith motion for an injunction asking the court to conduct a hearing on the best interests of the children, in which she recited all of the statutory factors involved in a relocation proceeding and asked the court to conduct a hearing and address those statutory factors.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to try to determine whether the length of time that passed between the submission of the stipulation and the signing of it by the court matters here. Would it be your position that the court could have signed off on the stipulation immediately after it was submitted to the court without conducting this inquiry that you're talking about now?
No, Your Honor, I believe it could not have. I believe that the court always has an independent duty to review the terms of any agreement which the parties submit in a dissolution case. For that proposition, I would refer you to 1410.112 and the cases of construing subsection 2 of that. The cases I have found, which I did not cite in my brief, all have to do with property issues and financial arrangements. According to 1410.112 subsection 2, property agreements have to be reviewed to determine whether they are unconscionable. For over 25 years, it's been well-settled law in this state that the district court has an independent duty to review those property divisions in an agreement to make sure that they are not unconscionable.
Ms. Dunn, let me ask you this. Here you did have review in 05, in the permanent order, I think it was 05, the permanent order said that the parenting arrangement cannot be changed absent court order or written agreement of the parties. And I think they're extenuating circumstances in your case because this is a contempt stipulation too, and you're doing more than just dealing with the kids here. But under those permanent orders, wouldn't it be enough if the court said, I've reviewed the case, both of these are incompetent, well-intentioned parents, and if they both agree in a move, I'm going to allow that move to occur. Would the court have to have a hearing? Or couldn't the court have said, I've already had a hearing and I've entered permanent orders that say these are the two conditions in which a move out of state will be allowed. And I'm not going to, parents act in the best interest of their children. I'm not going to second guess a joint decision by the parents. That's exactly what the permanent orders contemplate, isn't it?
The permanent orders may have contemplated that, but I would submit to you that the court always should review the terms of an agreement. Here, I think that the plain terms of this stipulation should trigger alarm that the best interests of the children are not being served by this. It was not simply a unilateral relocation. It did not provide any parenting time for mom unless she gave 30 days written notice to counsel, then she paid for her transportation from Denver to St. George, Utah, and additionally paid for supervised visitation unless she was willing to submit to supervision by her father's family. In light of the fact that the district court had found her indigent and appointed her counsel for the contempt proceeding, to place this financial burden on her in order to exercise any visitation when there was no set schedule, it was placed a complete burden on mom to exercise any parenting time with this financial hurdle to overcome in order to implement it. I think that was a red flag that the district court should have looked at very closely.
Well, let me ask you this. Part of your argument is that it happened 18 months later, and at the time it happened, the district court knew that mom certainly no longer agreed to the move, and to simply, I guess, and maybe this is better asked to the father's attorney, is the court simply applying contract analysis and saying, hey, you know, there's offer acceptance consideration and I'm just going to force this agreement and not consider the best interest of the children? Is that what you say happened here?
I think that is what the court did. I think that is a reversible error. I think it was particularly egregious in light of the notice contained in the mom's motions to the court. I would point out to you in the analogous context when the parties agree to a property division or even sometimes when there are children's provisions, in marriage of Shalott, there was an issue whether the party's agreement to provide a post-secondary education to the child was enforceable as a contract. And this court, that went to the Supreme Court, if I recall correctly. In Shalott, the Supreme Court said that the agreement, once it merged into the terms of a court order, was no longer enforceable as a contract, but it had to be reviewed independently. I would submit to you that this is an analogous situation, that the court, when it looked at the stipulation, did have a duty to review it. It should not simply enforce the stipulation as a contract. I think that the real crux here is that the court needs to review the agreement of the parties in order to ensure that the best interests of the children are protected.
Ms. Gill, the red flag you spoke about earlier had to do with cost to mother of traveling to Utah. In other words, mother thinks she made a bad deal for herself. What red flags were in the stipulation that would cast doubt on whether this was in the best interest of the children?
I think that it's not merely the cost, Your Honor, it's the fact that there was no set schedule of a parenting time for the mom at all, and that she had to initiate it. She also gave up her reintegration therapy with the children, which had been in place before she signed the stipulation. As a matter of fact, in the year between the contempt citation and submission of the stipulation to the court, she had been involved in therapy with Dr. Potter, who in December of 06, 1 month before the stipulation was submitted, had said that Dorian has excellent parenting skills, and he proposed moving to unsupervised visitation for her. So she clearly gave up something, and I think that particularly in the light of the public policy of this state to promote a relationship between the children and both parents, giving up reintegration and staying on a severely restricted parenting schedule is something that the court should have reviewed to determine whether that was in the best interest of the children.
Let me ask you this, Commissioner. I understand there are proceedings going on back in the trial court. There have been, father may have been held in contempt or threatened with contempt and brought the kids back at some point. What is the current status of the situation? Are the children still in Utah? And what particularly would our reversal do? Because the district court retains jurisdiction and is exercising jurisdiction, isn't it, over this matter?
Your Honor, that's a multi-part question, and I hope that I can remember all the parts as
I
answer.
It's more than two, I think. You're right, it's multi. So take your shot.
First of all, father was held in contempt and did bring the children back in just before Christmas of 08, and mom had a few hours of parenting time right around Christmas. That was supervised time. Pursuant to a second contempt, which the parties negotiated a settlement, mom had 26 hours of parenting time between January and April of 09. She has not seen the children since April.
And is the district court still exercising jurisdiction over the case?
The district court is still exercising jurisdiction. It's my understanding that it has finally set her motion to modify the stipulation for a hearing in February 2010. I submit to you that the length of time that the district court is taking to hear this is severe prejudice. It severely impacts the relationship between the kids and their mom, something that she has been trying to develop very sincerely, complying with the court orders. And the fact that the children are still in Utah and that mom's only contact with them is by phone is severely affects the relationship. I would submit to you that this case deserves to be prioritized. I think that when the children were removed with this severe impact and limitation on mom's parenting time is such that I would ask you to seriously consider bringing the children back to Colorado so that they can reestablish a relationship with their mother. I know this is an unusual request, but it's my understanding that in this particular case, dad is a pilot working for United Airlines. It is my understanding, and I'm sure if I'm wrong, I will be corrected by opposing counsel, that he did not change jobs when he moved the kids to St. George, Utah, that his job still is.
Although none of this is in the record, we really can't be reviewing these allegations.
You just asked me to go beyond the record.
I apologize, in terms of the current situation of where we are in the judicial proceedings, we can notice that, but I don't want to get into factual allegations about dad, pilot, or not changing jobs or whatever.
Your Honor, then I would submit to you that here the relationship between the children and their mother is of sufficient importance that it would be appropriate to bring the children to a location where they can have time with her mother as soon as possible, and that this be given a high priority. I'd like to save my remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly. And please the court and counsel, I thank you. Your Honors, much of the appellants.
Sir, Your Honor, your name?
Oh, I apologize. Leonard Higdon. I'm appearing with Tracy Dawson on behalf of the appellee, Steve William. I do apologize, Your Honor. Much of the appellant's opening brief in this case addressed fundamental liberty interests of children of the parents in this case, and the balancing between those liberty interests, right to travel, right to enjoy the rearing of their children and relationship with their children. And I submit to the court that fundamental liberty interests of parents are exactly what are at issue in this case. But more precisely, it's the fundamental liberty interests of these parents in making self-determined decisions in the best interests of their children. Now,
and is there some reason to, yes, given that, let's start with that, and in January of 07, let's just take it at the freeze frame it right there. Mom is under basically the barrel of a gun facing a contempt proceeding, and as part of extricating herself from that problem, she waives away fundamental interests in terms of allocation of parental rights. Isn't that a fair, it's almost like a plea agreement, isn't it? In a criminal context, you'd have to give, you know, go before a judge and say, here's what you're giving up.
Your Honor, I will not, what I cannot do is elucidate for the court or expound upon what the discussion in negotiation of that global resolution was. But in more direct answer to your question, I can certainly see where one might read into that agreement that there was some imbalance, perhaps, in the negotiation.
And in fact, she was appointed counsel. I don't want to get into the, you know, later suspension disbarment, but her counsel was appointed for the sole purpose of defending her against contempt charges. So he may have done a great job. He got her off the contempt charges, but then who is, he's not, his purpose is not to represent her in terms of parental rights.
Your Honor, I believe that, and that is a valid concern. I will point out, and it is my understanding, and I believe there's record support for this, is that the attorney who was appointed on her behalf relative to that contempt proceeding continued as her attorney, at least for some period of time, and I think it was something on the order of 7 or 8 months thereafter. What financial arrangements existed between them thereafter, again, is beyond my frame of reference or knowledge. But in answer to that, why I believe that's important for this court to consider is that Mom was not without resources. And in fact, and I believe, and not to belabor the points raised in our brief, but I do believe that this is of utmost importance for this court to consider that Ms. William, after entering into this stipulation, did indeed have second thoughts about the stipulation. And she did indeed file motions, in fact, multiple motions, seeking to be relieved of certain obligations and commitments and agreements within that stipulation. The first motion that was filed by her was to modify the terms relative to her access to medical information, with no mention of any other second thoughts or remorse or concerns over the parenting time arrangements and relocation provisions that she had agreed to. And that was denied. It was denied by the court, by the trial court, and this goes to the heart of our response and our position relative to this case is this. When the court received the stipulation of the parties and resolution of the contempt, including the provisions regarding relocation and including the provisions regarding Ms. Williams' future access to medical information, which was, by historical context, a major part of the straining of the relationship between the parties and the straining of the relationship between Ms. William and the children, the court, the trial court, it is our belief and it is our reasonable inference from the record, from the written record that we have, is that the court certainly intended to treat that as its order, certainly intended to accept that stipulation on behalf of the at the offer of the parties. And why we know that is because the court vacated the hearing on contempt. Ms. William benefited from that, of course, significantly. And then the court acted in conformity with that stipulation. And coming back now to the May 2007 motion that was filed by Ms. William seeking relief from the restriction.
May 08, is it?
No, Your Honor. It was May of 2007.
07?
The stipulation and resolution of contempt was right about January 5th, 2007. In May of 2007, she filed a motion seeking relief from the restrictions to her medical access to medical information. That order or that motion was denied by the trial court, wherein, and this is a part of the record, and I know that the court will review this, the trial court denied that motion, specifically referencing the provisions of the stipulation in January that addressed that.
So let's say, so your argument is that it's simply a clerical error, not signing it in January of 07. Mm-hmm. Let's assume that it had even been signed in 07, and then in May of 08, Mom is then saying, I need to be relieved of it, it was not done good. Shouldn't the court before simply basically rubber stamping Dad's proposed move without considering any of the factors in July of 08 at least held a hearing and said, is this in the best interest of everybody? Instead of just, hey, tough luck, you agreed in January of 07 to this, you got a benefit, and buyer's remorse is not going to be allowed here.
Your Honor, I cannot help but say to this court, however it may appear, the court is not entitled to, or excuse me, that's a poor word choice, but the court is not empowered with, at that point, I believe, the independent duty to override the party's prior agreement, which I believe it had intended to make an order of the court. And for all intents and purposes, all parties, including the court, had treated as an order. And I believe that the inference to be drawn there is that this trial judge determined that the order was the order of the court. It had not been modified, and until such time as it had been modified, then Mr. Gwilym was entitled to rely upon the order.
But viewed that way, wouldn't her motion be properly viewed as a motion to modify the order?
Yes, sir. And that motion is currently being dealt with by the trial court that is now sitting in that case. That the motions that were filed in March of 2008 were a motion to modify the stipulation, a motion to relieve Ms. Gwilym of her prior consent, written consent, to the relocation. She sought a modification, a global modification of the parenting time to relieve her of the supervised parenting time order that she had been under since approximately December of 2005.
But the court effectively denied that and approved a change of the status quo. I mean, the court effectively approved an out-of-state move by father by simply saying, you signed it in January 07. I'm not even going to give you a hearing on whether you have good cause to modify that.
Your Honor, my belief in response to that is this, is that Ms. Gwilym had granted her consent to Mr. Gwilym.
But she's saying, relieve me from that consent. There are all these reasons why it was not voluntary, it was not properly done, and most importantly, it's not in the best interest of the children to basically change whatever ongoing relationship I have that's going to, you know, not allow me to reunify and increase my parenting time.
And the only way that I can answer that is in this way. It is our position and belief that the court effectively did, by the adoption of the party's stipulation, by giving it effect, by acting on it in response to yet another motion, that this trial court fully intended to have adopted that stipulation and agreement as the order of the court and treated it as such, corrected its ministerial error in July of 2008 by signing off on that order, but thereby this trial court was not or did not find that there was any statutory requirement or constitutional requirement or other requirement to accelerate the hearing of Ms. Williams' motion, her later motion filed some 15 months later, to then not only just modify the terms of the agreement, but to seek a global reallocation of parenting time, to seek the appointment of the third CFI, the third child and family investigator, to conduct another investigation regarding the propriety of the parenting time restrictions that had been placed upon her. I cannot speak for the trial court. I can only draw reasonable inferences, and those
are trying to defend what the trial court did. And you're doing a good job of that. I'm just suggesting that you would not hold this up as a model of
I would not.
Good, okay.
Counsel, if the court had promptly held a hearing and had heard arguments on the propriety of the stipulation and whether it was in the best interest of the children, we would review the court's determination for abuse of discretion. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And the court did not do that, and you have argued ably, I might add, that the court's subsequent, essentially, enforcement of one portion of the stipulation manifests the court approval of the stipulation generally.
Yes, sir.
And so we're to infer from that the court has reviewed all aspects of the stipulation, including these parts that allow father to remove the kids unilaterally, and has concluded that that was in the best interest of the children.
Yes, sir.
It's hard to credit that as a proper exercise of discretion because it's so silent on that point. We really have no examination by the court on that aspect of the stipulation.
Your Honor, and if I misapprehend the court's question and I go off on a tangent, please.
I cause this a lot, so okay. I'm sorry.
I read and have read these difficult statutes, 1410, 124, 1410, 129, and I think the principal case that is being thrust as a controlling authority here is In re the Marriage of Cheslick. My position to the court is that as I read those, particularly those three elements of the law, and I read them together, I fail to find any requirement that a trial court, in the face of an agreement of the parties, must seize the reins of the parental decision-making process and seize control over that and override the decisions of the parties. Now, in thinking this through and in debating this point with colleagues, it's been, well, what if the parents decided they were going to sell the children into slavery, which is it's an interesting question. It's against the law to do that.
What if your analogy may be a fair one, I put aside the slavery issue, if the parents agree, that may be true, but this is a case where at least when the issue was presented to the court, teed up in May, if not July of 08,
yes,
the court knew the parents didn't agree, and the court was simply saying, Mom, you once agreed, and therefore I'm going to hold you to that agreement without a hearing. That's where I'm kind of, I'm not making any secret of where I'm struggling here.
Your Honor, and what I believe is the answer to that question. However, however some may find it to be unfortunate or unpalatable, is that it was the order of the court. The court had adopted that order. That order had not been modified. What if he had moved? What if he had moved in reliance upon the order and she changed her mind? Would the court then be required to bring him back, bring the children back?
I mean, she's asking, say, don't let him do what he's going to do, and she didn't even give Mom a hearing. I guess, she doesn't even, questionable circumstance of the January 07 stipulation. It's now challenged, teed up in 08, and she just says, retroactively, nunk-pro-tunk, or whatever, signs it when it's being challenged. It's a tough argument for making and doing a good job. I'm just struggling with that concept, not to hide anything from you, and I don't think I'm hiding very well.
You are not, and I appreciate that question, but I can only respond that was the order of the court, and the order had not been modified, and there is no requirement that the trial court accelerate or prioritize or conduct a forthwith emergency type hearing on the issue of whether an existing order ought to be modified some 15 months later. Wherein lies the emergency then? And so on the basis of that, Mr. Gloyan was entitled to rely upon the court's order until such time as the evidentiary hearing had been was able to be conducted. And it was Ms. William, by the way, who had requested that a complete and thorough CFI investigation be conducted as a part of that analysis for the court. And that CFI investigation is ongoing and
being conducted right now and is not yet completed, and I maybe will be soon. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The district court's order approving the stipulation when it was on notice that involved a relocation without making it an examination of the best interests of the children is a reversible error. 1410.129.2c requires the court to make a determination of the best interests of the children in that situation. Even if you were to look at 1410.129a about an agreement between the parties, I still think that would kick you back to 1410.112.2, which requires in subsection 2 that the court review the and determine that the best interests of the children are served when there is an agreement as to parenting responsibility, child support, and parenting time. Here the court was on notice that those were the issues being involved, that it was a relocation. Even if there had not been a relocation, I think the court still has a duty to examine the agreement of the parties to determine that the best interests of the children are being served. You see it routinely in the district court that the parties will submit proposed separation agreements and the court will review them and potentially modify them to ensure that they serve the best interest of the children. I think that Rule 16.2 requires this kind of motion to be heard on an expedited basis. Certainly 1410.129.2c contemplates an expedited proceeding. Unfortunately, between the load on our courts, these proceedings have become extremely cumbersome and time-consuming. I believe that was not the intent of the statute. The intent was to address children's interests quickly because the passage of time by itself has such a severe impact on young children. And these children are 9, 11, and 14. They are going for months, years, with having an impacted relationship with their mom. And I would ask you to reverse the district court's approval of the stipulation and make a clear signal that district courts do have a duty to determine the best interest of children when they review a stipulation between the parties. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel for their arguments. Good job all around. This case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.